This is a discussion of J.D. Salinger's A Short Story for Esme with Love and Squalor, and the title of this session is Secular Literature Really Spiritual? How many of you, I was going to ask how many of you will be able to be here on Friday when we finish up Esme, but I think you'll be okay and you'll get a good start on this, and that the two sessions tonight, Wednesday and Fridays, can be stand by themselves. I'd like to center our discussion around this idea. Criticism is consciousness after experience. And what I mean by that is to suggest to all of you that you are literary critics, and that in your minds and in your hearts, and I like to use the phrase in your guts, and that's where we read from, I think, first, is that you can do literary analysis. And you do it every day. And this idea, criticism is consciousness after experience, is you have some kind of experience either alone or with someone, and then you sit back and reflect, or you talk with someone about that. And as you reflect and as you talk, that experience takes shape, is given meaning, and you have a clearer understanding of the sense of that experience. Well, what you're involved in really is a kind of life-going literary criticism. Because these stories, all literature, is life. And then when you reflect on the things that happen in these episodes or in that life, you are in fact being a literary critic. So give yourselves a hand. You're all literary critics. And I think I say that in the onset because I think lots of us think that this stuff is hard to understand and it's only for English teachers. And where did he get all of that in there? Well, we're going to find where all of that comes from because it'll be in your mind, in your heart, and your guts. So we'll look at that idea, or we'll keep that in mind as we go through For Esme with Love and Squalor. The title of this discussion is Secular Literature Really Spiritual? And I would perhaps begin an answer to that by saying that all great literature, in my opinion, is spiritual. And by its very nature of being great, it must, underline it, it must consider those spiritual dimensions of our lives, or it can't be great literature. It's going to be maybe bad literature, or at best, good literature. Some good social political tract might last 20, 30 years, but it doesn't cover the universal needs and cries of humankind. So it won't be great literature. So that's part of the answer. More specifically with J.D. Salinger, the guy who has his books burned, thrown out of the public schools sometimes, in the private schools sometimes. I'm thinking of Catcher in the Rye. People who burn his books read not with good consciousness after the experience. We will do that together. I'm going to suggest to you that For Esme with Love and Squalor is a wonderful spiritual story about the power of the Holy Spirit, about the power of agape love. I don't know what the words that you want to impose upon this power, whether it's Holy Spirit, whether it's agape love, whether it's, it doesn't matter what your generalization is. It'll be your language imposed upon your experience of Esme and her life-saving act of giving a man who's insane a watch. The plot of the story is, and I won't spoil anything because knowing the plot of the story is not the same as experiencing the story. The plot of the story is there's a soldier about to go to war on D-Day, and he has these pre-invasion anxieties, and to kind of cope with his anxieties, he goes for a walk. And we'll see what he does on that walk. And then he meets a little 13-year-old girl, or he watches her sing in a choir because he steps into church and listens to them practice. And shortly thereafter, he meets her in a cafeteria and they engage in a 20 or 30-minute conversation. And the end of the whole first scene of the short story is over. And he goes off to war, promising this little girl, Esme, that he'll write her a story about love and about squalor. Squalor, the pain of human experience. Well, his story is about his own insanity caused by the war. And when Esme with Love and Squalor was written, it was first of all an anti-war story on that social level. But second of all, it's a story about, as I suggested, some kind of spiritual power that can transcend its way through the power of squalor and ugliness of war. Well, in trying to recover his mental faculties, he gets a box from little Esme, and in it is a watch that he knew meant a lot to her. It belonged to her father, who was a soldier killed in war too. And that watch saves his life, and he recovers his sanity. Plot enough, right? But this wonderful story will make you live that experience. I promise you it will. And you'll see it with different eyes. First of all, is it right to consider that J.D. Salinger cares about God, or is it only an anti-war story? I don't know, but in the context of all his writings, listen to him talk. First of all, in The Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield, the hero of the story, is talking. Finally, though, I got undressed and got in bed. I felt like praying or something when I was in bed, but I couldn't do it. I can't always pray when I feel like it. In the first place, I'm sort of an atheist. I like Jesus and all, but I don't care too much for most of the other stuff in the Bible. Take the disciples, for instance. They annoy the hell out of me, if you want to know the truth. They were all right after Jesus was dead and all, but while he was alive, they were about as much use to him as a hole in the head. All they did was keep letting him down. I like almost anybody in the Bible better than the disciples. If you want to know the truth, the guy I like best in the disciple next to Jesus was that the guy I like best in the Bible next to Jesus was that lunatic and all that lived in the tombs and kept cutting himself with stones. I like him 10 times as much as the disciples, that poor bastard. I used to get in quite a few arguments about it when I was at Wooten School with this boy that lived down the corridor, Arthur Childs. Old Childs was a Quaker and all. He read the Bible all the time. He was a very nice kid and I liked him. But I could never see eye to eye with him on a lot of stuff in the Bible, especially the disciples. He kept telling me, if I didn't like the disciples, then I didn't like Jesus and all. He said that because Jesus picked the disciples, you were supposed to like them. Because Jesus picked them, you were supposed to like them. I said, listen to Salinger speak for Holden Caulfield. I said, I knew he picked them, but that he picked them at random. Food for thought. In Raise High, the Roof Beam Carpenter, Salinger creates in all his fiction a mythological family. They're named the Glass Family. And Boo Boo, that's a story you haven't read. Sergeant X in this story for Esme with Love and Squalor is one of these glass children. Glass is, an important name that all of these children are very fragile. And all of Salinger's literature, by the way, deals with fragile, bright, sensitive young people on the verge of falling from innocence. Can you catch the book? Can you catch the child in the rye before he or she falls from innocence and prevent pain? No. Cynicism? Maybe. Can we work with the youth in our society? And that's Salinger's question, I think, on not just a social level and a psychological level, but on a spiritual level. Well, two of these glass children, Franny and Zooey, are born about 15 years later after 5 other glass children. So it's kind of a second family. One of the older glass children is speaking. One night some 20 years ago, during a siege of mumps in our enormous family, my youngest sister, Franny, was moved, crib and all, into the ostensibly germ-free room I shared with my eldest brother, Seymour. I was 15, Seymour was 17. Along about 2 in the morning, the new roommate's crying wakened me. I lay in a still, neutral position for a few minutes, listening to the racket, till I heard or felt Seymour stir in the bed next to mine. In those days, we kept a flashlight on the night table between us, for emergencies that, as far as I remember, never arose. Seymour turned it on and got out of bed. The bottle's on the stove, Mother said, I told him. I gave it to her a little while ago, Seymour said. She isn't hungry. He went over in the dark to the bookcase and beamed the flashlight slowly back and forth along the stacks. I sat up in bed. What are you going to do? I said. I thought maybe I'd read something to her, Seymour said. and took down a book. "She's 10 months old, for God's sake," I said. "I know," Seymour said. "They have ears. They can hear." The story Seymour read to Franny that night by flashlight was a favorite of his, a Taoist tale, and to this day, Franny swears that she remembers Seymour reading it to her. To save time, I'll summarize what the story is about and just read the ending. Duke Mu of Qin said to Po Lo, "You are an old man now, and you've always been buying my horses for me, and you aren't able to do that. Who can I get to buy my horses?" And Po Lo says, "I know a guy who sells vegetables and fuel and stuff. He'll go buy your horses." Great. So then Duke Mu gets this guy to go buy horses for him. He comes back, who has bought his horses, and doesn't bring the horses with him yet, just comes back and reports. "What's the horse like?" asked the Duke. "Oh, it's a dun-colored mare," was the reply. However, someone being sent to fetch it, the animal turned out to be a coal-black stallion. Much displeased, the Duke sent for Po Lo. "That friend of yours," he said, "whom I commissioned to look for a horse, has made a fine mess of it. Why, he cannot even distinguish a beast's color or sex. What on earth can he know about horses?" "Ah, has he really got as far as that?" sighed Po Lo. "Then he is worth 10,000 of me put together. There is no comparison between us. What he keeps in view is the spiritual mechanism. In making sure of the essential, he forgets the homely details. Intent on the inward qualities, he loses sight of the external." When the horse arrived, it turned out indeed to be a superlative animal. Elsewhere in Raise High the Roof Beam, one of the characters criticizes a lady about living her life in that to her face. And he says, "You know, I think she's never really understood the current of poetry that flows beneath all things. And it's in this world of poetry flowing beneath all things that Salinger creates his characters and tries to find the essence of their spirituality, not their color and not their sex, but the essence of their spirituality." How does one do that? In the last example, it's a direct statement about Christian thinking. Franny and Zooey, two college-age young people, twins, brother and sister, are talking about a man who says a prayer. "The part that stumps me, really stumps me, is that I can't see why anybody, unless he was a child or an angel or a lucky simpleton, would ever want to say the prayer to a Jesus who was the least bit different from the way he looks and sounds in the New Testament. My God, he's only the most intelligent man in the Bible, that's all. Who isn't he head and shoulders over? Who?" And he lists a whole bunch of guys, and I'm going to save time again. And he says, Jesus puts Moses to shame, and Solomon, and Isaiah's, and David's, they're nothing. "Moses, don't tell me Moses. He's a nice man, and he kept in beautiful touch with his God and all that. But that's exactly the point. He had to keep in touch. Jesus realized there is no separation from God. Oh my God, what a mind," he went on. "Who else, for example, would have kept his mouth shut when Pilate asked for an explanation? Not Solomon. Don't say Solomon. Solomon would have had a few pithy words for the occasion. I'm not sure Socrates wouldn't have for that matter either. But most of all, above everything else," and this is the last illustration I want to use to suggest to you the dimension of Salinger's spiritual considerations. "Most of all, above everything else, who in the Bible, besides Jesus, knew that we're carrying the kingdom of heaven around with us, inside, where we're all too goddamn stupid and sentimental and unimaginative to look?" And it's the beginning of Salinger's breaking down of our vision of what society is and does to our spiritual values. It's a sentence, I think, as a student of literature, worth memorizing. Who knew but Jesus that the kingdom of God is inside us, where we are all, and listen to his condemnation of our social vision, where we're all too goddamn, and he doesn't use that kind of language to sensationalize it and to titillate our, oh wow, it's kind of a good one. he uses it to condemn. Where we are all too goddamn stupid and sentimental and unimaginative to look. With that, we will begin for Esme. If you have it, you want to follow along. You know the plot. And we're about to go to war. And I'm just going to read parts of the dialogue. And do we have enough to split up here? We got some in the front row who don't have any. Okay. I think you'll be okay listening. You people can share, maybe. And what I'm going to do is skip through and primarily concentrate on the dialogue so you have a sense of the plot and that you have a sense of the unimaginativeness and the sentimentality of lots of characters who could share their love with this soldier, but who don't. Just recently, by airmail, I received an invitation to a wedding that will take place in England on April 18th. We have in this story the now, the present, and this guy gets an invitation to come to Esme's wedding. And then he reflects to his pre-war day. And then we jump up to the, I'll call it the post-war, D-Day and V-E-D, V-E day, post-war days. And then we're back to the now at the very end of the story. So we have really three time periods, and that's I think, easy to follow. Well, he's got this wedding invitation, and it happens to be a wedding I'd give a lot to be able to get to. And when the invitation first arrived, I thought it might just be possible for me to make the trip abroad by plane, expenses be hanged. What do you make of that? He can't afford it, maybe. Desperately wants to go. Esme means something considerable to him. And you'll learn later, this girl that he talked with for 30 minutes? So already we have a strange sense of how can 30-minute relationship mean so much. I've since discussed the matter rather extensively with my wife, a breathtakingly level-headed girl. And we've decided against it. For one thing, I'd completely forgotten that my mother-in-law is looking forward to spending the last 2 weeks in April with us. I really don't get to see Mother Grenshaw terribly often, and she's not getting any younger. She's 58, as she'd be the first to admit. All the same, though, wherever I happen to be, I don't think I'm the type that doesn't even lift a finger to prevent a wedding from falling flat. Accordingly, I've gone ahead and jotted down a few revealing notes on the bride as I knew her almost 6 years ago. If my notes, and I want you to listen, Theodore Reich, the psychologist from the University of Chicago, suggests that when we counsel and listen to people, we should listen with our third ear. That's not a bad idea for literary criticism either. Listen with more than just what we hear. T.S. Eliot says, between the reality and the idea lies the shadows. And in the shadows of life is where we experience the tensions. And that's the part we want to become conscious of. Well, listen to him say, if my notes should cause the groom whom I haven't met an uneasy moment or two, so much the better. What do you think that means? Just answer from your guts. How do you feel about him saying that? Yeah. The groom is going to think, what's the deal here? But part of what's going on is I'm going to show you, reader, that you're going to be uneasy too, and you're going to suspect that there has to be some kind of sexual attraction here between a man and a woman. And the groom is going to suspect the same thing, and he's going to be uneasy. And the point of the story is there is absolutely no sexual attraction. It's a kind of sharing and giving that is the simplest kind of love that symbolizes itself into something even greater. But we are all too stupid and unimaginative to look past when a man looks at a woman, there must be. Right? So listen to him comment then. Nobody's aiming to please here, really to edify, to instruct. Well, then we have the story begin. And he recalls his day before he goes into war. I was among some 60 American enlisted men who took a rather specialized pre-invasion training course And as I look back, it seems to me that we were fairly unique, the 60 of us, in that there wasn't one good mixer in the bunch. We were all essentially letter-writing types, and when we spoke to each other out of the line of duty, it was usually to ask somebody if he had any ink he wasn't using. When we weren't writing letters or attending classes, each of us went pretty much his own way. Mine usually led me on clear days in scenic circles around the countryside. Rainy days, I generally sat in a dry place and read a book, often just an axe length away from a ping pong table. Feeling? You laugh. Why? What is there about that? An axe length away from a ping pong table. No hidden message, just again, respond. Why did you laugh? I did too. I mean, what a crazy, you know.
The juxtaposition is so incongruous.
Yeah, is the ping pong table
very suggestive of, yeah.
These loners. How do you cope? I'm going to go into war. How do you cope? Play ping pong? Just play ping pong. Tomorrow we go to war, guys. Not an axe length away. He talks about the training course in the middle of that next paragraph. By 3 in the afternoon, I'd packed all my belongings into my barrack bag, including a canvas gas mask container full of books I'd brought over from the other side. The gas mask itself, I'd slipped through a porthole of the Mauritania some weeks earlier, fully aware that if the enemy ever did use gas, I'd never get the damn thing on in time. I remember standing at an end window of our concert hut for a very long time, looking out at the slanting, dreary rain, my trigger finger itching imperceptibly, if at all. It's an anti-war story. His trigger, you think his trigger finger is really itching? I can't wait to get out there.
I was reluctant.
Yep. And this guy was an axe length away. I could hear behind my back the uncomradely scratching of many fountain pens. I came away from the window, put on my raincoat, cashmere muffler, galoshes, woolen gloves, overseas cap. That's just typical Salinger, listing the specifics. And then after synchronizing my wristwatch with a clock in the latrine, I walked down the long, wet cobblestone hill into town. I ignored the flashes of lightning all around me. They either had your number on them or they didn't. What do you make of that? Either had your number or they didn't.
And fatalistic about it.
Sure, fatalistic, thinking about death. I didn't hear what? Sure. How do you go into war thinking that you might be responsible for your life or your death? I mean, that's a pretty heavy load. So instead, they either got your number or you don't. And how do you cope? Well, that's part of it. And that's that you use the word fatalism.
And the absurdity of having a clock.
Yes. Yeah. And to synchronize your watch with it yet. Yeah.
To me, it's a comment on the comfort of a clock.
Good. And that's right. It sure is. Good.
I couldn't hear it.
Repeat. It's a comfort.
It's a comment on the discomfort of a military environment.
Yep.
What they'll provide.
Yep. Yep. Well, this is definitely an anti-war story. And he leaves. And then at the bottom of the next paragraph, I looked at my wristwatch, then back at the board. He's looking at a bulletin board in front of a church. A sheet of paper was tacked up, listing the names of the children expected to attend practice. I stood in the rain and read all the names. He doesn't even know her yet, though. But you're right on. I got to focus on something. When I read that, I always think of going into my first comprehensive examination for my degree. And the test is 5 minutes away, and I remember standing in front of the bulletin board reading every single college advertisement that was there. I mean, I didn't care about that, but I had to focus on something because I was so scared about this test coming up. Let alone war coming up. Well, he sees Esme singing, and I'll skip that too. And we're moving on then to page 91. She sings in the choir, and she watches them, and I encourage you to read this. It's in the library. There are copies in the bookstore, I believe. They might be out. I can't remember. We looked at this story 3 weeks ago, too. He goes to the church, he sees Esme singing in this choir, just notices her because she's a little taller, she has a little stronger voice, and she stands out. but nothing more than that. And then he leaves and goes into a coffee house. In the middle of the top paragraph on 91 is where I'll begin there. He orders tea and cinnamon toast. It was the first time all day that I'd spoken to anyone. I then looked through all my pockets, including my raincoat, and listen to this carefully, listen with your third ear. This man who we've already shown the pre-invasion anxieties that he's built up. And I finally found a couple of stale letters to reread, one from my wife telling me how the service at Schraff's 88th Street had fallen off, and one from my mother-in-law asking me to please send her some cashmere yarn first chance I got away from camp. Camp. We're all too stupid and sentimental and unimaginative to reach out and give our presence to someone else. And this is before the war, and we're going to see him with his face jumping and his knuckles bumping together, and he can't read, and his gums are bleeding because he smokes constantly. His hair is dirty, and he feels his mind like insecure luggage on an overhead rack. He says about his mind, it's a horror picture because he's conscious of his growing insanity. He can't just flip out and not know it. He feels himself going crazy. Well, that's after the war, but we can see building up to that all the possibilities to save him. Just reach out for me. But then, no, send me some yarn. While I was still at my first cup of tea, the young lady I had been watching and listening to in the choir came into the tea room. Well, we'll turn the page. I want to read their dialogue and give you a chance to talk and get all the way up to the second scene of the story before we're done. Esme comes in with her little brother, Charles, and their governess. I'm on page 92 now. Charles is 5, Esme is about 13. Charles acts like a little kid. And Esme walks up to Sergeant X, we don't know his name yet, we'll learn it later, and says, now on the bottom third of 92, "I thought Americans despised tea. It wasn't the observation of a smart aleck, but that of a truth lover or a statistics lover. I replied that some of us never drank anything but tea. I asked her if she'd care to join me. Thank you. Perhaps for just a fraction of a moment." This girl's 13. I got up and drew a chair for her, the one opposite me, and she sat down on the forward quarter of it, keeping her spine easily and beautifully straight. I went back, almost hurried back, to my own chair, more than willing to hold up my end of a conversation. This guy who sat an axe length away, this guy who the first time he's talked with anybody, it was to order cinnamon and toast, is now willing to converse. What? Is he sexually attracted? I mean, there's no indication in the story. You don't understand that. It's important that that's it. There's nothing in the story that suggests that. There's something else about... I remarked that it was certainly a terrible day out. "Yes, quite," said my guest in the clear, unmistakable voice of a small talk detester. She placed her fingers flat on the table edge like someone at a seance. Then almost instantly closed her hands. Her nails were bitten down to the quick. I think we have squalor number one for Esme. Her nails are bitten to the quick. She was wearing a wristwatch, a military-looking one that looked rather like a navigator's chronograph. Its face was much too large for her slender wrist. "You were at choir practice. I saw you." I said I certainly had been. I said I thought she had a very fine voice. "I know. I'm going to be a professional singer." "Really? Opera?" "Heavens no. I'm going to sing jazz on the radio and make heaps of money. Then when I'm 30, I shall retire and live on a ranch in Ohio." "Do you know Ohio? What do you make of that?" "When I'm 30, I shall retire." Anybody here 30? Huh?
She's out of touch with reality herself.
She's 13.
Yeah, she's out of touch because she's 13. That's great statements. This is a kid. And 30 is old, isn't it? And so she's not in our reality, she's in her own. We must remember that. This is a child whose nails are bitten down to the quick. And we'll see why in a moment and why she wears her watch. I offered her a piece of cinnamon toast. "No, thank you. I eat like a bird, actually." I bit into a piece of toast myself and commented that there's some mighty rough country around Ohio. I know. An American I met told me, you're the 11th American I've met. You go to that secret intelligence school on the hill, don't you? I replied, I was visiting Devonshire for my health. Really, I wasn't quite born yesterday, you know. And I want to say, yeah, you're right. Because we're going to learn soon that this little girl bites her nails to the quick because her father was killed in war, her mother is dead, and she's been evacuated. And she was not caught in the rye. She suffered all the pain of falling from innocence before anyone could catch her. But there's something about her, her magical presence, and we'll see what that is. I wasn't quite born yesterday. I said, I'd bet she hadn't been at that. You seem quite intelligent for an American. I told her that was a pretty snobbish thing to say, if you thought about it at all, and that I hoped it was unworthy of her. She blushed, automatically conferring on me the social poise I'd been missing. Well, most of the Americans I've seen act like animals. They're forever punching one another about and insulting everyone, and you know what one of them did? I shook my head. One of them threw an empty whiskey bottle through my aunt's window. Fortunately, the window was open, but does that sound very intelligent to you? It didn't especially, but I didn't say so. I said that many soldiers all over the world were a long way from home, and few of them had had many real advantages in life. I said I thought that most people could figure that out for themselves. Possibly. My hair is soaking wet. I look a fright. I have quite wavy hair when it's dry. I can see that. I can see you have. Not actually curly, but quite wavy. Are you married? I said I was. Are you very deeply in love with your wife? Or am I being too personal? I said that when she was, I'd speak up. Wonderful paragraph, and this is the great style of Salinger. She put her hands and wrists farther forward on the table, and I remember wanting to do something about that enormous faced wristwatch she was wearing. Perhaps suggest that she try wearing it around her waist. It's humorous, and we laugh, and therefore we remember it, but we know that this watch doesn't belong on her. But we also know that I will wear this watch no matter what, because it's Dad's, and Dad was killed. And it's also the watch that she'll wear no matter what, that in the end of the story she's going to give away to this almost stranger, this gesture of love. Usually I'm not terribly gregarious. Watch her vocabulary. You sometimes forget she's 13, but we're reminded of that by her, I want to retire when I'm 30. I purely came over because I thought you looked extremely lonely. You have an extremely sensitive face. I said she was right that I had been feeling lonely and that I was very glad she'd come over. I'm training myself to be more compassionate. My aunt says I'm a terribly cold person. I live with my aunt. She's an extremely kind person. Since the death of my mother, she's done everything within her power to make Charles and me feel adjusted. Just note, and I won't condescend to you, you all know the grammar enough to note that phrase, comma, phrase, or clause, independent clause is the, or I mean dependent clause, I mean, it depends on something else. It can't stand by itself. We put those in the beginning of sentences because they're the least important. After class today, I'll meet you at under the bell. The point that's important about that sentence, psychologists tell us, looking at language, is the second part. I'll meet you under the bell. And the first point is, it'll be right after class. Well, she puts the death of her mother in a subordinate clause. How do you cope? She's done everything to make Charles and me feel adjusted. I'm glad. Mother was an extremely intelligent person, quite sensuous in many ways. Do you find me terribly cold? I told her, absolutely not. My first name is Esme. I don't think I shall tell you my full name for the moment. I have a title, and you may just be impressed by titles. Americans are, you know. I said I didn't think I would be, but that it might be a good idea. Just then I felt someone's warm breath on the back of my neck. I turned around and just missed brushing noses with Esme's small brother. Miss Megley said you were to come and finish your tea. Charles says to Esme. He was looking very splendid in a brown Shetland shorts, a navy blue jersey, white shirt, and striped necktie. He gazed at me with his immense green eyes. Why do people in films kiss sideways? Sideways, I said. There's a problem that had baffled me in my childhood. I said I guessed it was because actors' noses are too big for kissing anyone head on. Listen to Esme. His name is Charles. He's extremely brilliant for his age. How many times have you heard extremely? But extremely, very good. Extremely a lot, yeah. He's extremely, extremely brilliant. Watch her relate to him. Charles gave me the fishy look my question deserved, then wriggled downward and forward in his chair till all of his body was under the table except his head, which he left wrestler's bridge style on the chair seat. "They're orange," he said in a strained voice. He picked up a corner of the tablecloth and put it over his handsome, deadpan little face. "Sometimes he's brilliant, sometimes he's not. Charles, do sit up." He misses our father very much. He was S-L-A-I-N in North Africa. What do you make of that? Your feelings? Yeah.
She's playing mother.
Playing mother, protecting him. Maybe yourself. How do you... My dad's dead. You mean the slain? Yeah. Yes, for sure. That's a good observation. Yep, distance is it. Good. Yeah, it is. Makes it. It's better than dead. S-L-A-I-N, somehow. Yeah, good. Okay, you're into it. That's consciousness after experience. Your experience is you've lived with Esme, and you're sensing her pain, and now your consciousness. Yeah, great statement. You're 30 when your mom and dad are dead. You're 30 when you've been evacuated from your house and when you're taking care of a little kid. Have your own child, right. Huh?
You're very unwilling for
it. Right. Yep. Very good. Okay. Criticism, you got it. You can erase it. Well, Charles goes, and Esme says, "Stop that." He saw an American do it in a fish and chips queue, and now he does it whenever he's bored. "Just stop it now, or I shall send you directly to Miss Megley." Charles opened his enormous eyes as a sign that he had heard his sister's threat, but otherwise didn't look especially alerted. Esme gave me a long, faintly clinical look. "You have a dry sense of humor, haven't you? Father said I have no sense of humor at all. He said I was unequipped to meet life because I have no sense of humor." Watching her, I lit a cigarette and said I didn't think a sense of humor was of any use in a real pinch. Father said it was. This was a statement of faith, not a contradiction. Watch this mother protect the son. Charles misses him exceedingly. Remember that, because later they're going to leave and then they're going to rush back in and she's going to push Charles toward X and say, "He wants to kiss you goodbye." And we wonder who's being projected. Yeah, who wants to kiss whom? And yeah, good. Charles misses him exceedingly. He was an exceedingly lovable man. He was extremely handsome, too. Not that one's appearance matters greatly, but he was. He had terribly penetrating eyes for a man who was intrinsically kind. There's no such word as intrinsically, and she screws up. But it's this floating in one world of retiring when she's 30 and the world of my mother and father and war have done to me. Oh, yes. I nodded and I said I imagined her father had had quite an extraordinary vocabulary. "Oh, yes, quite," said Esme. And Charles runs up. "What did one wall say to the other wall? It's a riddle." I rolled my eyes reflectively ceilingward and repeated the question aloud. Then I looked at Charles with a stumped expression and said, "I gave up." "Meet you at the corner." It went over biggest with Charles himself. It struck him as unbearably funny. In fact, Esme had to come around and pound him on the back as if treating him for a coughing spell. "Now stop that. He tells that same riddle to everyone he meets and has a fit every single time. Usually he drools when he laughs. Now just stop, please." "It's one of the best riddles I've heard, though," I said, watching Charles. He then looked at me with his exposed eyes, which were full of slowly subsiding mirth and the pride of someone who knows a really good riddle or two. "May I inquire how you were employed before entering the army?" He tells her he is a writer. "Published?" It was a familiar but always touchy question, and one that I didn't answer, just one, two, three. I started to explain how most editors in America were a bunch. My father. She interrupts him even. What do you make of that? And this relationship between Esme and her father. What do you think? Yeah. And extremely, extremely, exceedingly. And then he says, how most editors in America were, but my father wrote beautifully. You want to understand that, because it's this father who's left this wonderful symbol that ought to be around her waist that she's going to give away. So that, as she says to him before he leaves, I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact. Now that comes from someone who understands war. What's the worst thing that could happen to you in war? To Esme, it's not death. I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact. And when you read the story, you'll learn that X is his name, he disguises it. X watches his jeep mate, his buddy in war, blow a cat with a gun, I mean blow a cat off the hood of the jeep. That's crazy. Rich's word earlier, it's absurd. Well, how do you make sense out of life when that's going on? I hope you return. I mean, she understands it, and I'm setting you up for that with these kinds of this look at Esme's relationship to her father. I'm saving a number of his letters for posterity. And then she looks at her wrist on page 90, on 100 of me. He gave it to me just before Charles and I were evacuated. We've heard three things now. Four. Her nails are bitten to the quick. Her mother, just before she died. My father was S-L-A-I-N. And we've been evacuated. What does she have? Yep. Yep. And a brother. Purely as a memento, of course. I'd be extremely flattered if you'd write a story exclusively for me sometime. I'm an avid reader. I told her I certainly would if I could. I said that I wasn't terribly prolific. It doesn't have to be terribly prolific, just so that it isn't childish and silly. I prefer stories about squalor. About what? Squalor. Squalor. The bottom line to human existence. Pain. Despair. Trying to cope, in this case specifically, with a war. I'm extremely interested in squalor. And Charles rushes up, what did one wall say to the other wall? And we're never allowed to stop thinking or to forget that we've got children here. And that it's going to be a child who saves the adult. He answers, I'll meet you at the corner, and the instant I said it, I wished I hadn't. Charles' mouth fell open. I felt as if I'd struck it open. He stepped down off my foot and, with white-hot dignity, walked over to his own table without looking back. He's furious, Esme said. He has a violent temper. My mother had a propensity to spoil him. My father was the only one who didn't spoil him. And she speaks, and they're going to leave now, and in the middle of 101. Do you think you'll be coming here again in the immediate future? We come here every Saturday after choir practice. I answered that I'd like nothing better but that. Unfortunately, I was pretty sure I wouldn't be able to make it again. In other words, you can't discuss troop movements. Would you like me to write to you? I write extremely articulate letters for a person my... I'd love it. I took out pencil and paper and wrote down my name, rank, serial number, and APO number. I shall write to you first so that you don't feel compromised in any way. Goodbye. They leave. When you read the story, note how he treats her. This little kid. Most of us adults talk to little kids, and we just sit there. Yeah, see you later. Have a good day. He gets up from his chair like he's been entertaining the queen. Something's happened in this magic moment that isn't sexual, that has to do with just the presence that he's able to give her and she's able to give him that he hasn't experienced from his relatives, right? Hey, send me some cashmere yarn when you get out of camp. Hey, business is really falling off at Schraff's. If you were receiving that letter, what's missing? Yeah. How you doing? What you thinking about? Where you going next? Hey, business is really falling off. I bet you want to know that, huh? Squalor.
That's right.
The squalor isn't only in the war. It's in the vision of the human beings dealing with him who are too sentimental. Not the love kind of sentimentality that's real, but the, you know, kind of schmaltzy sentimentality. Yep, nice phrase, psychologist. Socially desensitized. And it's happened where we're all too could be. And that could be an analysis of the people who write, but our story here, and our story, is with his response to that, and what does he get from that? Her failure to deal with it. And that's a nice observation. It sure could be. In any event, they are not communicating about what's most on his mind. We know that why. Because he's reading the names of choir kids on a church poster? He's sitting an axe length away from a ping pong table? We know that there's some kind of pre-invasion anxiety. Let's just finish this scene, and then it's your turn completely. They end. They're going to leave. She comes back, and less than a minute later, Esme came back into the tea room, dragging Charles behind her with the sleeve of his reefer. Reefer, folks, is a jacket with a little belt on the back. This kid started young, didn't he? Charles would like to kiss you goodbye, she said. I immediately put down my cup and said that was very nice, but was she sure? Yes, she said a trifle grimly. She let go Charles's sleeve and gave him a rather vigorous push in my direction. He came forward and he asks the riddle again. What did one wall say to the other wall? Meet you at the corner, Charles says. And then Esme, and the scene ends. You're quite sure you won't forget to write that story for me? It doesn't have to be exclusively for me. It can't. I said there was absolutely no chance I'd forget. I told her that I'd never written a story for anybody, but that it seemed like exactly the right time to get down to it. She nodded. Make it extremely squalid and moving. Are you at all acquainted with squalor? I said not exactly, but that I was getting better acquainted with it in one form or another. And we know, don't we? All the time, and that I'd do my best to come up to her specifications. We shook hands. Listen to her insight. The 13-year-old who's been through squalor. Isn't it a pity that we didn't meet under less extenuating circumstances? I said it was. I said it certainly was. Goodbye. I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact. We'll talk about where we are so far, but where the story goes next is, as he says, this is the squalid part of the story. And he discusses his insanity and describes it, and he describes his army partner coming in and looking at him and saying, Jesus Christ, your face is jumping all over the place. You got a goddamn tick in your face, did you know it? And X goes like this. Yeah, I know. Tries to cover it. And the pain of his increasing insanity is so clear. And it's clear in the story, if you can't be here Friday, note, it's clear in the story that nothing can save this guy. Nothing. He opens his letters for therapy. He burns some string wrapped around a box for therapy. He sits down and tries to type, and he can't even make his fingers work. I mentioned already his gums are bleeding. Every time he touches his tongue to his gums, they bleed. He's triple reading paragraph and his knuckles bump together incessantly. That's how he's described. And then he talks about some of his war experiences to his war partner. And his mind is like insecure luggage. And it's clear in this story, and it's clear that Salinger understands it, there's nothing that can save this guy. And there's some other stories by Salinger where a mother or a father or some person comes into the child's life and tries to lift them up out of their pain and squalor. And sometimes it works. But in this story, note that it's going to take more than the love of some person. But Esme's watch does it. And we'll look at that on Friday if you're here. But if you're not, note that this watch does it. And this watch is from someone that doesn't love him like a daughter or a sister or a mother and like that. There's no kind of, maybe the Greek kind of word would be eros love for him. It's just knowing that the force of love itself exists hey, I've been through war. And I guess, look, the title of the story, for Esme, with love and squalor. And I imagine, when I look at that ending, of this flower of love just fighting its way up through all the squalor of war. And it transcends it. And his knowing that, it's not his wife, it's not Esme's person, it's the power of the symbol of the watch. This kind of agape love. Love exists. Boy, I'm okay. It does exist, and I'll find, you know, and there, oh, we'll look at that, right. Okay, your turn. From your guts, criticism is consciousness after experience.
I guess the word that kept popping into my mind, well, not a word, but I was watching this self-described loner grasp almost greedily this fundamental human contact, and it was clearly a person who was a loner not by choice,
yeah,
but by the necessity of the pain, the his own internal pain, and the squalor he perceived,
yep,
down the road.
Nice third ear. I mean, we feel, don't we? And that's where you first do literary analysis, is how do you feel? An analogy for me is, in that kind of, you're thinking about a story in that kind of literary analysis, is the band director is up here directing the band, and he's going through everything, and we better go back to B and start again. He goes back, and they go to, I say he, because my band director was a male, and he goes back to B, something's wrong there, let's do it again. And finally, after about five times of starting at B, he turns to the third trombone and says, is that a B sharp or a B natural, your plan? Aha, found it. My point is, you just know something and you kind of sense it. In the band director's analogy here, he hears it. Doesn't know what it is exactly. His consciousness isn't quite there. And he hears it again and again and again, and finally he's got it figured out. That's what we do with literary analysis. That's what we do with experiential analysis. Something about this. So my point is, we start from our guts or our ear, and then we keep going. And as we articulate it, it takes shape and order, as you've done. Anybody else? Very nice. And rebel comes from, partly, doesn't it, our feelings, again, our guts. The feeling we get about sitting an axe length away, as opposed to an arm's length. That's a rebellious kind of image. Very good.
But the surprise is that often we keep children out of turtles.
Yes.
And Esme's a child.
Yep. Nice, too. Esme's a child, but she can't be frivolous anymore. Charles, she puts the napkin away for him. Do sit up. Her frivolousness is over. Yet we know she's young because she wants to retire when she's 30. Good.
Latching on to that, typically a little child shall lead them.
Yeah. Nice. And Salinger is aware of those kinds of biblical concepts throughout all his stuff. His main theme, I think, through all literature is children.
In certain contrast with that, I think that our society would probably wonder rather suspiciously at a young man who spent a half an hour talking to a 13-year-old who picked up in a corner.
Because we will look at not the spiritual mechanisms. Every one of you guys are on, just hired on the faculty at Augustana College. Literature teachers. You asked what I offered? We will look at the ending, and if you can't be here, I encourage you to read it. And if you're gonna, these are all the copies we have in the village. When you're done, why don't you bring them back and just stick them in front of the door of Chalet 1. That's where I live. And then I'll bring them to class again Friday. If you're coming to class Friday with the ending, then just keep it and bring it to that. But if you have a chance, you're not going to be here, and you have a chance to read the ending, please do. It's a fine story.